This is James Jude Courtney. I'm the new Michael Myers, and you're listening to the Epic Film Guys podcast. Thanks for being here, guys.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. This is the end, guys. This is the end. This is the last episode of horror season for 2018.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah, I'm just going to leave that hanging out there for a bit. This is the last episode. Dot, dot, dot.
No one told me this news, but okay.
No, I see already ya. Done told you. You're fired until you go get that fucking burger that you posted in the dumpster from Burger King.
I told you, man. I went.
It's worth
it. I called the Nightmare Burger from Burger King is not available in my area. And based on what I saw on Twitter, Instagram, and on Facebook, literally no one was able to find this thing. I could not find one instance of someone actually finding one to buy it.
Order it.
Which is leading a lot of people to believe that it may be possibly like a hoax or a joke thing, considering that they're marketing this burger as nightmare inducing. I don't know. But I really wanted to try it, and I promised you guys that I would try to have it on the show. So next week, if I can get my hands on it, we'll still be recording before Halloween.
It's true.
So it'll still be, in my mind, horror-related and horror-centric. And yeah, so I'll still do it if I can get my hands on it. I'll make Saucy buy it for me, too.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are thrilled to have you here tonight on a brand new episode of the Epic Film Guys podcast. I, of course, am Nick.
And I am Justin. We are joined once again by the god of podcasting himself. We are graced by his presence, ladies and gentlemen. He's ditched us the last few weeks because he's just way too cool for school over in this motherfucker.
You go to one Hollywood premiere and all of a sudden you're just big boss bitch.
Yes, bow and exalt, or it is I.
Well, we, of course, I mean...
Happy to be back, gentlemen.
It's only fitting that the sauce be here and that Justin be here, because it's the night.
Yes!
Loy Sauce is excited. Finally, now, they got to see the movie a fucking eternity ago. Released a spoiler-free discussion of it, but they've only been able to really talk to each other about the movie and a few other people that have seen it at festivals and whatnot. Tonight, full in-depth review of David Gordon Green's Halloween.
You don't believe in the boogeyman? You should.
You're not my dad.
Yes.
It's Michael Myers down, is my dad.
Really?
Then wouldn't you be the embodiment of pure evil? That means he got laid. That could never happen. That could never happen.
I'm that baby from Halloween 6. I'm that baby from Halloween 6 that they leave in a bathroom at one point.
Jamie Lloyd's baby. Yeah. God damn it, man. I don't remember.
Because
when we did our full...
Yeah, because isn't Michael the father of that baby? So he raped his niece, I guess?
Something like that. Yes. Yes.
But
that's right.
That doesn't matter anymore. That doesn't matter. We'll push it to the side because we're talking about.
None of it matters.
We're talking about another Halloween film.
None of it. So hush up. None of your sequels matter anymore. They're all gone.
But if you do want to listen to us ramble on about these sequels, a year ago, Saucy and I did actually do a retrospective on the entire series.
A B-side? What?
Yes. It was a B-side, but we'll put that episode number in the show notes if you're interested in checking that out. But no, we're here,
man,
and only here
to talk
about.
That's an awful lot of commitment to me to try to remember that you said that to then put it into the show notes.
I will message it to you on social media so you remember it.
He said, winking, because he knows he'll never remember either. But yeah, so full in-depth review before the break. We're going to do some non-spoiler stuff. which they already did in the YouTube thing, so whatever. But I haven't gotten a chance to talk about it at all, so I'm super excited to talk about it.
I don't really care what Justin has to say about this movie. Yeah,
fuck you, Justin.
At this point,
you've probably really heard him know what talk Nick about thinks. It like incessantly for weeks now, and you're probably finally like, "Thank God I get to talk to other people about this movie," because you won't shut up about it.
Well, seriously, because again, I'm not trying to like brag or whatever, but it was torture, you know, not getting to talk to people about the movie. I'm like, I want to talk about it, but I can't because no one else has seen it.
You say you don't want to brag, but when you watch our spoiler-free video, you specifically say, "We saw Halloween today, and you didn't." That was to our audience. That was to our audience. So that's, you definitely were boasting. You were very boastful about that.
That was me being facetious. I wasn't actually boasting.
Okay.
We just released today, as of recording day, a piece that we did with two girls on a bench, Trisha and Shauna, which was amazing, talking about William Friedkin's The Exorcist, the director's cut, which I didn't realize I watched until we were halfway through that recording.
Yeah, I still can't believe this. We're like, I asked you before the episode, which version are you watching?
The version regular that version. I got doesn't say it's the director's cut.
But I specifically said director's cut, and you said regular. That's what you texted me. I still have it. I can send it to you, screenshot right now. So I watched the theatrical cut, and I missed the spider walk because of you.
Yeah.
And
then Why would you watch the theatrical cut?
I don't know. But you Why? Also...
I watched the theatrical, because I thought that's the version we were going to talk
you
about.
Missed the, you also missed the demon heads appearing on the random fucking kitchen appliances, like
which
the
is
blender.
One of the
like,
worst
all of a sudden
things
the fucking did. Blender's possessed. That shit's gonna come to life and grab Ellen Burstyn's hair and start blending it up.
It is true. It is true. But God, I really wish that I would have gotten to watch the version that I watch every single time I want to watch. But it was a great, great time talking about that with those gals, and I really had a blast.
Wonderful.
So.
Loved experiencing that movie for the first time. It was really, really great. Not that I'm going to be like, I need to watch The Exorcist all the time again, but whatever. It was a really, really good experience, so I really, really did enjoy it. But
I think whenever you want to get turned on, you'll watch it. True. You know what scene to skip forward to.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got too much to do. Too much to do tonight for idle chatter and small talk. So, gentlemen, we're going to rush right over into that time-honored segment. Of course, I'm talking about
What's
in Saucy's Drawers.
I mean...
Wait, I messed that up. We're not doing the What's in Saucy's Drawer segment, right?
I'm back! Puke and rally! Yeah. Woo! Give me a beer!
Well, Justin apparently has an empty glass, so you're not even drinking anything anymore, are you?
I finished this beer. I finished it. By the time we got to this point in the show, I got a good pounder this week. This is a good pounder, so that's why it's gone.
Well,
yes.
Tell us all about it. The sauce can wait. The sauce... He's savoring it right now.
I'm sure he is savoring it. He loves to savor his liquids. But
that's
this
a
is a
cum.
Beer that I actually saw at Wegmans. They were doing tastings. Now, Nick, I know this isn't a thing up home, right? You don't see beer tastings in Wegmans.
Do they? Periodically,
okay.
Yep.
So they do it up there. They never used to do it. But now down here, every single weekend, I go to my local Wegmans and they're doing wine tasting and beer tasting. And Captain Lawrence Brewing Company, I know you can get some of their beers up there.
Yep.
They had their Orbital Tilt IPA Citra version, and I had a taste of it, and there were only like 2 6-packs of it left, and I was like, this is a good pounder. Like, it tasted really good, very creamy mouthfeel, and
Wait a minute.
Mouthfeel? Yes. It was a very creamy and smooth mouthfeel. It's dry hopped, of course, which is one of my favorite types of IPAs, and it's lower level ABV. It's only 5.9%, and it's 65 IBU, so it's a little bit more bitter than the traditional New England that I drink, you know, on a week by week basis. But no pumpkin beers for me tonight. I've kind of taken that, and you know, I've shot my wad on the pumpkin beers for the rest of the month. For the most part, I may get another pump with a P King just to round out the end of the month.
Pumpkin King.
But this is delicious. I actually like this. I could drink all of the 6-pack in one night if I wanted to, which is kind of a waste, but it's good. I like it. I would recommend it.
I did, ladies and gentlemen, send a photo to Justin. So first of all, I got 4 pie pumpkins I broke down into puree. I even made pumpkin loaf this past weekend, which turned out amazing. Hear all about it on this week's restaurant podcast. Wink. But I sent Justin a photo of 2 more pie pumpkins that I promised him I'm going to turn into pumpkin beer. I'm going to do it. I'm going to try to make a pumpkin pie beer.
Really, oh, boy.
I don't even know how I'm going to do it. I'm just going to do my best. Hopefully it'll turn out, but I got like, it's not going to take two pie pumpkins to do a batch of beer, obviously, but I really, really can't wait. I'm kind of actually excited to try my hand at it. But Justin, this is a special day for me. This is a special day because Beer Tree Brewing up in Port Crane just celebrated 1 year. And so to celebrate 1 year, they released a beer that I've been dying to get my hands on since the first time I had it. And this is their Salute Your Shorts New England Style Double IPA. It is, as you have described so many of Aslan's beers before, Justin, and you can see just kind of the consistency of it there. It looks like fucking grapefruit juice. It tastes like a goddamn juice bomb. It's just a light bitterness from the hops that kind of carry through it. The mouthfeel is so robust and fruity and citrusy. It's incredible. It's beyond description. My words don't do it justice. I adore this beer. I will save you one because I know you'll be up here in a month. So I will save you one so you can have it. But it's just incredible. I was so sad when you went to Beer Tree last time you were home that they didn't have it and you didn't get a chance to try it because you went up there and tried some beers and you were like, yeah, there was some good stuff.
That's right.
But nothing was really mind blowing. This beer is going to blow your fucking pants. I cannot wait for you to try it. It's incredible. I started off before the show, though. I started off with some of the beer cold as fuck forever, which I still have a ton of, and that's a really great beer, too. I made that, though. It's really good. But Justin, before we roll out of this segment, we got to kick it over to him, the god of podcasting himself. Ladies and gentlemen, Loy Slosh. What have you got pouring into your penis funnel this evening?
Into your peepee hole.
Schlafly Pumpkin Ale.
What a story, Mark.
That's the end. That's all I have to say.
Wow.
I reviewed it. I talked about it.
Oh, good
before.
For you.
It's that one lone beer that you've had sitting in there since the last time we recorded it that you have not drank yet. So it's there.
I don't conveniently, drink beer.
Conveniently for the Halloween episode, it's a pumpkin beer. We're talking about Halloween. There's pumpkins, jack-o'-lanterns. It perfectly fits. It's a good choice.
If only I had candy corn to go along with my pumpkin
ale. I got a bunch
ale.
Of candy corn here, but you can't have none.
You know when I went to breakfast in Geneva and we went to the captain's room? They had a candy corn bread. I was not brave enough to try it.
What?
They always make homemade breads like every day with really I had apple bacon bread I was telling Justin last week. But they had a candy corn bread, but I would have had to buy a whole loaf of it, and I would have been like, do I really want to commit myself to a whole loaf of candy corn bread? I don't know.
I like how you say that. You didn't say candy corn bread. You said candy corn bread.
No, it's candy corn in bread. It's not corn bread. It's candy corn bread. Candy corn cornbread would also be interesting in different ways, I feel. Might work better, too. Never mind. Anyway. Shut up. You know what? If you keep derailing me, you know what? No Halloween. It's all over. Everybody just rate the movie. We're not talking about it at all. And then we're going to talk about fisting. Your second segment of the show.
I'll do a half hour review of Beetlejuice the musical.
Done. Beetlejuice.
At least somebody saw it. I didn't.
Man. You should see it. It's fun.
But, all right, fine. Justin, take the ice pack off of your blue balls. I know.
Ding, 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 ding.
There was one time when we were talking about Halloween, and Justin held his phone up to his microphone and had the Halloween theme playing, and I wanted to drive to Herndon and fucking stab him.
I believe that was when we did our John Carpenter retrospective with the countdown.
Yeah, that was two years ago. This week, actually.
Exactly. But no, we are here to talk about David Gordon Green's Halloween. For me, this movie, it's been over a year in the waiting. As soon as they announced that they were actually green lighting a brand new Halloween film, it was an extremely exciting moment for me because Anyone that listens to the show already knows it, but if you are a new listener, Halloween, the original 1978 Carpenter classic, is my number two favorite movie of all time. So the idea of seeing a sequel being made, a direct sequel to Carpenter's film, kind of ruffled the feathers of a lot of fans. And rightly so. I mean, a lot of fans love the sequels, myself included. Saucy, you and I sat down and talked about all of the sequels last year for the Halloween season, and you watch through them and you can see that there's great and there's good and there's bad of the sequels.
And there's dreadful, like, shit heaps as yes. well.
But there are a lot of movies that a lot of fans love. And I said this in the patron-only segment of the show. The Halloween franchise has a very dedicated, diehard fan base, the likes of which is very similar to Star Wars fans. I mean, these people are very passionate about these movies. Even some of the bad sequels, there's a huge fan base for them. So the idea of cutting out all the sequels, we've seen it before with H2O, where they removed 4, 5, and 6 and just made it a direct sequel to 1 and 2. This is basically the same idea, but just removing 2. Was that a good idea? Did that work? Well, we'll get into that, but I loved the idea of it. I was excited. When you saw the talent behind it, the idea of seeing comedic talent behind it, like Danny McBride on the script and David Gordon Green, it was out of left field that I really liked that idea. It wasn't what you see traditionally in Hollywood, where it's like a James Wan type character comes in to deal with the film and to oversee everything. This was a very interesting idea. And I was really excited. So I'm finally sitting down to unleash everything about this movie. But I'm going to throw it to you, Saucy. I got to throw it to you first. What were your initial thoughts? Spoiler free for now on David Gordon Green.
We're going to save Green's the spoilers for
Halloween. Well, on the soundtrack, there's a track titled Halloween Triumphant, and that could have been the title of this film, and it would have been very fitting, because this is a triumph on just about every level. It's not a perfect film, as I said in our spoiler-free YouTube review. It's very, very good. I will say that as far as the filmmaking and the craft goes, it is the best written and directed, the most well-presented, I guess, of the sequels. This is coming from someone who is a fan of Halloween 2 and Halloween H2O and, to a lesser extent, Halloween 4. I think this is an impressive piece of work. I think it is very respectful to the original, while also being its own thoroughly modern thing. David Gordon Green really made it his own while also paying respect to John Carpenter's classic original. This is as close to the original in terms of quality as I think we're ever going to get. So, it's a ringing endorsement from me, but we have one person who
haven't heard anything from him at all. Not so, one thing.
Hey, Nick, what'd you think of Halloween?
Shut up!
Oh, man.
Wrong!
No, I'm just kidding. I really wanted to get Justin's, like hairs tingling on the back of his neck and stuff. And
my face is a little red if you couldn't
really
see.
Make it really get him really, really worried. No, there's so much good stuff in this movie. I think what this film gets most right of anything, and I mean of anything, is the presence of the shape. The whole film is incredibly tense. It's one of those thrillers where you're legitimately concerned for everyone involved the entire time you're watching it. It's that kind of movie. My biggest problem with this movie, and it's not a spoiler, it's in the trailers, and this is, I know, a nitpick. What are we on right now, gentlemen? We're on a podcast, okay?
That's right.
The entire genesis of the plot of this movie, the whole plot of this movie is kicked off by these podcasters who are going back in and they're looking at the old Michael Myers case and going to the mental institution and whatnot. But let me tell you, okay, as somebody who I work so much every week on this show, you cannot have one microphone in the middle of the table, 6 feet away from everybody who's fucking talking into it, because it's going to sound like everybody's yelling into tin cans in fucking wind tunnels. It's going to sound absolute complete fucking garbage. So I love you, Hollywood, and I love so much about this movie. I'm going to be very, very high on this movie, rating-wise, in the end. But the podcasting thing, fuck you. You're so full of shit. No podcaster ever who even remotely gives a fuck about anything is going to be like, no, this is fine for audio quality. You can't even hear me. It sounds like I'm yelling into a fucking tunnel right now.
Well, especially if they're offering $3,000 for an interview. Yeah.
Nick, you know what I thought of you? Because that opening scene where they're in the courtyard, presumably to interview Michael Myers, the female podcaster has that one tiny microphone out and... she's behind Michael, so if he were to say anything...
she's not going to hear him anyway.
Right.
I was so...
like, so I thought of you at that moment. I'm like, Nick is going to have a problem with this scene.
It was the Laurie Strode interview that really got me, because there's... for fuck's sake, let's have some decorum here. You cannot, as a podcaster, just stick a microphone in the middle of a fucking table. Laurie Strode is an eternity away from this microphone.
They offered $3,000 for the interview, and they even said we came a long way for this. So yeah, you know they what? Came a long if way. They're going to pay three grand much, for the interview.
If they're going to pay her that much, if you got $3,000, you buy a fucking lapel mic and you wire the bitch up. Or you put that fucking zoom right in her face so that audio sounds crystal fucking clear, baby. Done.
So that's a 3 out of 10 from Nick. Justin, your rating?
No, it's funny. I'm not shocked there. But I won't lie. I kind of liked the inclusion of a podcast. I liked the idea when I heard this way before I saw the movie. I heard that the movie was based on, you know, creative journalists / podcasters going in and trying to research the old case. Because that's a true crime. As we just had Dina from Twisted Philly on here. You know, it's a big thing. I love true crime. And a lot of the true crime stuff and the obsession with murderers and murder and killers and serial killers in general is huge in pop culture. It's a very big thing right now. So they use those themes in this movie throughout. But I like the idea of podcasters kind of starting off and them being new characters that we didn't know, that were fresh to, so it could kind of set the movie off in a different way.
About it.
I get it.
I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, I don't know.
But those of the people out there that have already watched our spoiler-free reaction, they already know. But I have to release this. Because I'm make no mistake here. I already know I'm the bigger Halloween guy on this show out of all three of you. Like, it's been like a special Halloween? Thing to me ever since I was 14 years old. Like, literally, I live Halloween.
Why didn't anybody tell me?
But I really, really, really loved this movie. I do have some reservations about it. There are those glaring issues that literally, you know, I'd say 85% of the people out there that are critiquing this movie are having a problem with. I totally understand where you're coming from. We are going to dissect those issues. But for the most part, the little things that I had a problem with aside, this movie is the truest, most faithful in spirit and tone to John Carpenter's original, even more so than I feel like any of the other sequels. And I felt like up until this point, the ones that got the closest were Halloween 4 and probably even more so H2O. I get H2O gets a lot of shit. Yeah, there's 3 or 4 different masks. Yeah, there is a score that's not cohesive, but I still like what they did with it. And a lot of what they did with that movie is basically what they did with this movie. But this movie is the most special. So much care and precision went into this. And you could just tell that everybody involved sat down at the table and all had a cohesive vision of what they wanted to make. They wanted to make something faithful to a classic movie, but still make their own modern adaptation of this type of story. The boogeyman is out there and he's going to get you. It's very simplistic. We don't need any subplots, which we may have, but we don't need any backstory or anything. We just need the boogeyman's loose. He's going to get you. And that's what we get with this movie. And I can't toot his horn enough. Yes, he was on this show, but man, we got the most visceral, brutal, terrifying version of the Shape, aka Michael Myers, with James Jude Courtney in this interpretation of the character. I was so happy with everything that he did in this movie. So like the stars were aligned. And guys, we got to talk about this right off the bat, because this is not a spoiler. This movie is Laurie Strode's movie. This movie is about her character, trauma, how she's dealt with it for 40 years, and how she's prepared every single day of her life to fight for it when she gets the opportunity, and her actually taking that chance when she gets it to fight back. And Jamie Lee Curtis gives a career best performance doing so.
I think the thing that makes me love this film as much as it does is the strength of the performances, not only of Jamie Lee Curtis, but also Judy Greer and Addie Matichak. I think all three of them give absolutely fantastic performances, and they have character arcs, which is something, especially in a horror film, that you don't generally see all that often. Generally, it's very static, very flat characters that they just throw in there as cannon fodder for the killer or whomever to slash up. And granted, this film has its cannon fodder, obviously, but I love that she has that character arc. I love that they approached the idea of Laurie Strode kind of just being haunted by this whole thing, the post-traumatic stress of the original encounter defining her entire life. I really, really liked that they approached it from that angle. I think you're exactly right, Justin. I think this is one of Jamie Lee Curtis's best performances. I adored her in this movie, but I want to shift from her really quickly to talk about Judy Greer, who I think, like, imagine growing up in that household, imagine growing up in Laurie Strode's household and constantly learning about all these things and constantly, like, bearing your mother's emotional baggage over this traumatic event that she endured. And, like, how would you even inhabit that space? And I think Judy Greer nails it. I think she gives a fantastic performance. She obviously deeply cares for her mother. She obviously is really, really affected by everything that's happened to her mother, but at the same time, she's also exhausted by it because
she's had to cut herself off from it. Yeah.
It has also defined her entire life, and she wasn't the one that lived through that, and she doesn't want that to be her only experience. And I love, like I said, I think all three of them right at the top, and Jamie Lee Curtis released that photo on social media today of the three of them together. And it's just amazing. Three generations of Strode women, and what a powerhouse trio they are in this film. Without this trio, without the really, really sharp writing, for their characters and the great performances, this film would not be nearly as effective. It would just be another brainless, like, good brainless, but brainless, pointless slasher flick.
You know, and you mentioned Judy Greer, and I had my reservations about her because obviously we're big Arrested Development fans. You know what immediately comes to mind when you think of Judy Greer.
I wanted her to flash Michael Myers and say Spring Break.
But, you know, I had to get over seeing her in the first Jurassic World. And with this, I did have, again, I thought about, I was like, man, she's one of the only pieces of this puzzle that doesn't really fit. But after seeing the movie three times, I can safely say that I buy her as being Laurie's daughter. She looks like her daughter. She feels like her daughter. They have a great chemistry together. My only issue would have been is I would have liked to seen a little bit more. I know that for a horror movie, you don't want anything longer than like 2 hours 20 minutes at tops. And this movie was a little bit long as it was, being over the 2 hour mark for most general moviegoers. So I would have liked to seen a little bit more of her character. We get a little bit here and there, but I think it was just enough to really feel what she was feeling and understand where she came from, especially that one flashback, which I thought was really well done.
I do think some of the exposition was a little bit clunky when she is talking to her daughter about her childhood. It seems very sudden, and it seems like, okay, this was here specifically because, like, they had to have this conversation now because the plot says so. Like, it never came up before, ever. It seemed a little bit clunky to me, but as Nick said, in a slasher movie like this, where you don't get characterization really ever, it's a refreshing change of pace to have the characters actually feel something and have conversations with each other that build on their characters. And man, is that something that I appreciated about this movie.
I have to say, one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie, just to piggyback off what both of you are saying, particularly Nick and his love of the performances and of this trio, is the dinner scene, because we see them all interact. We see Laurie and what she just witnessed and what she's going through. You can see how exhausted she is and how emotionally drained she is and how she's just basically done. And we know how many people in this day and age let go. They give up. And you can just see her. She's just fighting. She's fighting that feeling of giving up. And you see her drink almost a whole glass of wine, and she just breaks down.
Great moment.
And she just breaks down. That's Jamie Lee Curtis's just amazing performance seeping through in that scene. And all of them, they're all really good in that scene. The movie, when it gets to that point, really made me like, I was like, this is something special. This is beyond what I thought it could be.
It really speaks to Jamie Lee Curtis's immense talents that when I saw the trailer I had mentioned that it was like the badass Sarah Connor version of Laurie Strode, but, and that is the case. You get a lot of that here, but you also get the extremely vulnerable side to Laurie Strode. You get kind of that gamut of she is a fighter, you know, she is a badass, but she's also experiencing such pain and trauma and regret and guilt for how, you know, the family has turned out and how she wasn't there for her family always. And it leads to some emotional scenes. And imagine that emotion in a Halloween film.
That's genuine, like I said, emotion. I think when you go back to it, I think we have to segue into break because we have to get into The Shape. And I don't think there's any way to talk about Michael Myers in this film without spoiling a great deal of what happens in the film. So we're going to run into a break in just a moment. But like I said, I think it goes back. When you take a horror property like this and when you treat it seriously, as they obviously did here, when you sent out, like Justin said, they wanted to pay homage to what Carpenter did. And I really, really felt shades of Carpenter a lot of times in this film. I really think that David Gordon Green absolutely nails it a lot of different aspects. But then there are those modern elements that keep kind of creeping in. And I think it's a really, really great marriage of the two. And I think it all goes back to how smart and how sharp I think the writing is for that trio of just wonderfully talented women. And we haven't mentioned Andy Matichak's role a lot here yet. I think we'll do it more so in spoilers than anything else. But
fantastic performance.
It's all three of them. They anchor this film and they make this film as investing as it is. Because you care so much about them as characters, and because of the absolute force of nature that Michael Myers is, you care about their plight. Like, you fear for them, and it just kind of puts you on edge. It puts you on a really, really tense.
I think what it gives you, Nick, for lack of a better word, is it's suspense.
Yeah.
It's suspense like you don't get in most modern horror films. They did their best. And I think they executed it pretty well with going back to the first Halloween and looking at it. It is suspense. That's all that first movie is. The kills are brutal, but they're not all about the gore. They're not all about the blood. It's all about the lead up, the build up to everything. And this movie had a lot of great times of suspense in it.
Yeah. So yeah, I want to run over into break really, really quickly here. And when we get back, I'm going to kick it over to Lloyd Sauce, because there was a very, very specific moment in this film that made me think of Loy Sauce, because he's often said on the show, when he sees children in mortal danger, he falls in love. And so we're going to start with that when we come back.
What is happening?
Yes!
Get Justin Eskimo back on this call. I'd rather have
I am drunk as fuck, though, too, so.
You just fucked my mind, man.
This is my favorite song, man. How did you know?
This is my jam.
This shit came out when I was like a
fucking senior in high school. I love fucking Roxette, man.
Know you're something in the wake of your smile.
I love her gozer hair.
Woo! I get an emotion by the look in your eyes. Yeah.
Fuck me, I'm drunk.
I only played this because Caleb mentioned it over in the Skype.
Oh, god damn it.
When she's calling for you.
Caleb, thank you for turning on your video just to do that.
Nothing else we can do.
That's awesome, man.
Yes.
Perfect.
Hi, Vanessa.
Tell him goodbye.
Oh my god. Okay.
You know what I did, Nick?
What?
I listened to my heart and I opened another beer.
I fucking love you. What do you got now?
Must have been
I have. Yo, of course. I have Evil Twins from Tennessee with Smoke. Tribute to John's homeland.
I hate you.
Yeah, I'm just. God,
this
damn,
one's good. It tastes like a barbecue. You like smoke beer?
Yeah, I fucking love it.
Yeah,
why did I do this?
It's the smokiest beer I've ever had, other than Hamburger so area, Norwegian wood.
On my pillow, see the winter.
What is going on right now?
Awake or lonely.
It's
a
just don't
silence.
Ask questions, Shampoo. Just don't ask questions.
Hey, I'm going with it. I just want to know where this is going.
Touch me.
I've been
now.
Hurt before.
I close my eyes.
Dream away.
I don't want to stop it until Justin stops singing.
But I lost it somehow.
I'm never happier than when I do these fucking megasodes. I swear to God.
This is amazing.
Oh my God. Oh, I fucking love you guys. All right.
This is what we should have just done for 2 hours. Just the right? Movie Pod Squad sing along.
Yeah.
I'd listen.
Alright. Now, Loy Sauce, it has been said on this show multiple times that when a child is put in danger,
and this is true,
you get excited. You love it. You adore it. When a child dies, I should have pulled the sound clip and put it on the soundboard. I really should have. But when a child dies, you adore it. And we're getting into full spoilers here on David Gordon Green's Halloween. And one of the first kills that Michael Myers has in this film is a fucking kid.
That's when you know the movie's not messing around. I do love to see children in mortal peril. In movies. Not in real life. In movies.
I'm cutting that. I'm just cutting that whole qualifier. It's just going to sound like you're a fucking psychopath.
In movies, I want to see a kid get decapitated. I want to see a kid get strangled. I want to see a kid get stabbed.
These are going
to
make great sound bites for the soundboard.
And so, in motion pictures...
He's going to keep qualifying it now.
So anyway, yes, Michael Myers strangles a young child to death in a scene that is very reminiscent of the original when they stumble across the mental patients. It is extremely creepy the way that scene is framed, very much an homage to the original when you see all the mental patients wandering around in the darkness.
I did like the dialogue between the young man and his father. It's late, it's cold, and they're out. They're going to go hunting, which a lot of people do when they live out in the country. A lot of, you know, dads that are brought up that way, they bring up their kids that way. And we can see this is a modern movie because the kid, you know, he says, "I love spending time with you, Dad. I love doing this on the weekends, but I really dance is really important to me." And I thought that was, you know, they had balls to have a kid say that in a movie, a male character say that, because back if you did that 10, 15 years ago, the audience would be like, "Oh, that's gay.
What a fucking pussy."
Exactly, something like that. But now it plays well. It plays fine. Then you see the kid actually take charge when his dad goes out missing, when they go into the bus that's crashed, and he has a rifle drawn, and he's actually very efficient with it. And
I were talking about the fact that we thought in the trailer that shot, we thought that was a grown man.
It looked like a grown man. I'd never noticed it was a boy, a small boy.
Right.
But
so
in the trailer, it's just a very quick shot. But I really liked that scene. But we got to get into this. This is one of the most important things about this movie for all of us, especially Halloween fans. The fucking kills. Michael Myers is brutal. He's violent. He's visceral. He is cold fucking blooded in this movie. That's what you need in this movie. And I feel like they upped it up a notch compared to the original, but this is not on the level of Rob Zombie's giant hulking wannabe Michael Myers slashing away at his victims 1,000 times. This is something
literally
that,
stabbing someone 27 times is not scary.
This is done faithfully to the original, but still a little bit more edgy and more brutal. And I think that first kill initiates exactly what you said. We're not fucking around. We just killed a kid, a very young kid. This isn't a teenager. This is a small, I would say he's probably about 9 or 10 years old, maybe 11.
I'd say a little older. I'd say 11 or 12. So it's letting the audience know early on, Michael Myers is back. Michael Myers is not going to take no prisoners. Michael Myers, unfortunately, does not murder the baby, which I was very disappointed by.
I also thought of you during that scene. I was like, please tell me he's going to just fucking stab the baby. And I was like, Lois also probably jump out of his fucking chair and start applauding.
I wanted to see Michael Myers pick up that baby and throw it out the window. No,
he stops. They make you, they give that suspense, that moment where he stops and he looks after he just brutally murdered an old woman with a hammer.
Well, we
drops
talk
the
about
hammer
that scene
and grabs
too.
We will. I feel like we should talk about the kills and everything, but we got to start from the beginning, man. We really got to, you know, I don't want to jump around here too much, but the beginning, man, the opening of this movie is just amazing. Set aside Nick's issues with the podcasting microphone problems that would never be, you know.
I was telling Lois during the break.
It's a movie.
I was telling Lois during the break. Nobody'd ever listen to their show. They'd tune in for 2 minutes and be like, the audio on this sounds like fucking garbage, and they'd shut it off and unsubscribe.
They'd say, let's listen to True Crime Garage instead.
Exactly.
No, but it's a movie.
There's something really special about the way they open this movie. There's a visual style here that we have not seen in a Halloween movie. It's brilliant looking, and I love the way it builds up until you see Michael Myers. Now, a lot of fans are actually complaining that you see him out in daylight, but guess what, ladies and gentlemen?
Oh, come on.
Give
me a break.
They wouldn't have him out there during the nighttime, so you'd have to see it. And I actually love the aesthetic of that area there, which is actually, I guess it's like a marine, it's a military campus of some sort where they shot that and made it look like it's a prison. But I really love that aesthetic of like the checkered flooring and everything. It just looked vintage and old. But I love how they walk up and they build the scene with the dialogue and how the podcaster gets closer and closer to Michael Myers. And they only hint at the side of his face. You don't see the front of his face. You just see the eye, and they automatically hint at the fact that look at his eye. His eye is fucked up from his encounter at the end of the original film. And it just builds and builds and builds, and the music just pushes and pushes and pushes.
Cut to title sequence.
Yes. And one of the best title sequences.
The title sequence in this film is outstanding because it immediately, number one, you're already like creeped out, like that looming threat that Michael Myers is already affected in that opening. And then you cut to just the so reminiscent of the original film. You get the iconic score plugging its way in there. Perfect, legitimately perfect, the way it cuts into those titles. And then I just love that rotting pumpkin slowly reconstructing itself. That is just such beautiful imagery. It's grotesque and nasty, and then it just slowly retakes its shape.
Letting audiences know this is the resurgence of a franchise.
Yes, very symbolic. Hey. Very, very on the nose. But and then they use the same exact font as the original. Yep. When it pops up, it's the same font, and it's the same exact pumpkin, the same carving of the same iconic design of the original jack-o'-lantern from the original Halloween. That's one of the little homages to the first film. And that was all David Gordon Green's idea. He really wanted this to be for fans. And I'm going to say that a lot in this, that this movie is a true love letter to fans, made for fans. One could say it's fan service in the way that The Force Awakens is fan service, and I would agree with you, but it also still has enough originality that it's still its own thing. But that opening, literally, Saucy, when I saw it the first time, and even last night on my third viewing, when that title comes up, Halloween, it just jumps up, and then the theme starts, and you see that pumpkin, I start to tear up, because I'm like, this is a movie made for me, because I love this, and you know that I love this, and you're doing this special for me, just for me to get excited. And that's, oh man, such a great opening.
I got emotional too. Definitely. I'm not a fan on the level that you are, but even myself as a fan of the first film and as a fan of the franchise, it is extremely special to see.
There's not just love and homage to the original film here. There are glaring homages to the sequels. Okay, let's get to it right now. Let's jump into the scene. The amazing tracking shot that harkens back to Dean Cundey's beautiful cinematography with the Panaglide from the original film, where you first witness the shape with the mask on walking the streets of Haddonfield at night when kids are out trick-or-treating. The kids run into him, and that's when the shape returns. John Carpenter's amazing, eerie new score pops in, and you see him walking towards the garage. That whole sequence was literally pulled pretty much you know, almost scene for scene to an extent, right out of Halloween 2. The woman is even wearing the Mrs. Elrod, you know, she's got the her curlers in, she's wearing the same colored robe, she's making a sandwich, the cutting board is out. He comes in, he bashes her to death with a hammer, and then he takes the knife. One of my favorite scenes in the entire movie. But that doesn't end there. The whole tracking shot, that one shot, does not stop there. He walks through the entire house. It gets to one of your favorite parts, Loy Sauce, where he doesn't kill the baby. I know you wish that he did. And then he walks out to the front steps, and he continues to stalk. There's no cuts in this entire scene. And then he walks up to, I know what is one of your favorite scenes, so I'm going to let you talk about it. The next kill.
We see Michael, his face in the window, and this woman comes in into the room, and you see his shadow on the house, you know, the next house over, walking, and you see her start to pull down the blinds, and he appears behind her, grabs her by the back of the head, stabs her right through the throat.
He smashes her head down first. He smashes That's right, her head he down does. First, and then Nick, when that knife goes through the throat, that was not a fully practical kill, but it looked fully practical to me. It looked real.
The great thing, and this is a really good point to talk about it. I want to go back really quickly in a moment here and talk about the death of the two podcasters, which I found overly satisfying for some reason.
We have to talk about that. It's one of my favorite scenes of this whole movie. Oh my God, it's so good.
But we get a contrast with a lot of kills in this film. A lot of kills, they don't show on screen. David Gordon Green has the sense, and I will say that again, the sense to hold back. He doesn't just get full out brutal. Let's see the lady get her head bashed in with the fucking hammer. Let's see this kill. Let's see that kill. He holds back. There's like the tracking shot when he goes to the gas station. We just see the one guy walking from his car into the gas station, and we just see in the background Michael Myers fucking like beating the shit out of one of the guys in the garage. Like it's far away in the background. It's barely even noticeable, but it's there. And there are so many kills that happen in this film that are just implied. And it goes back to something that I think it was Loy Sauce that said it during the first segment, that it's that looming threat. It's that just kind of implied violence. It's that threat of violence that Michael Myers represents that really makes it that much more effective. And then when you get to see those kills, like, dude, the guy podcaster, the dude just legitimately repeatedly just getting his fucking skull bashed into concrete over and over. Or
how terrifying would that be?
Smashing her head down and just grabbing her by the fucking head and just jabbing that knife through her fucking throat. Like, dude, so satisfying. Because when you get the violence, when you get to see the kill, he implies, you don't get to see everything. You don't get to see everything. He gives you like the littlest touch of like slasher blue balls. Like he knows everybody, like the slasher fans, especially like you guys. You're like, oh, I want to see a good kill. And then he holds back, builds that suspense. And then jams a fucking knife through a throat. And you just see that fucking knife pop through the throat. And it's just like
the gas station scene, I think it builds perfectly. It has that suspense. It does what you should do in a Halloween movie. You see he's in the background. He's looming. What is he going to do? And I think what's most terrifying is that the female podcaster, she's in there going to the bathroom. Number one, he goes in there to kill her.
She was doing number
two. Yes, but he goes in there. He goes. Yeah, she mentioned something about going number two. That's right. She is taking crap.
I was really hoping he was going to come back to that.
It's true. She actually mentions it, which I thought was interesting. He goes in there not only to kill her, but he goes in there to terrify her. He goes there to play with her. Michael Myers loves playing with his kills. He doesn't just, he likes to fuck with you. He's not just there to just, he could go there and rip the head off and walk out. He's there. He's sadistic. He enjoys it. So he goes in there to terrorize her. He's shaking the fucking door, shakes the door. And then how terrifying would it be to be her? She's already scared that he's there. And then he comes in, her partner, he hits Michael Myers with the crowbar, and then he just gets his face smashed in. Imagine being her and how scary that would be, like seeing that guy.
All you're doing is hearing it.
You're feeling it. You know that, and then you know you're next, and then she gets it. And then it leads to what is one of the most iconic scenes in any Halloween movie ever. There's music, but it's very quiet. It's very silent. It's slow. He walks up to the trunk of the car. He slowly puts the mask on. As soon as he slips the mask on, you hear the iconic breathing. And then he shuts the trunk. And then it's like, there it is. This is for fans. This is, how could you not love this? This is it. That's, oh, I'm at a loss for words because of it. Because that whole scene for me, especially the first time I saw it, I was like, this is it. This is one of the best Halloween movies ever made. Nick, we're going to get to you because I'm surprised you haven't come off and spouted off at the mouth about it yet. But he literally becomes a plot device at one point in the film because there's no other way for things to move forward without that character there. I liked the character initially. I really liked the introduction to him, this guy that played him. I cannot say his name for the life of me. Haluk Belgener. Don't know how to say that, so I fucked it up. But I thought he was good. He also had that kind of slight campiness and hokiness that Donald Pleasance played the original Loomis as in the original film. There's a little bit of camp there. But when he started showing up more and more, I was like, okay, this could be fine. But there's that what the fuck moment. There's that what the fuck moment that happens that I know 80% of people...
I want to dial it back even before the what the fuck moment, though, because I like the character at first, kind of like you said, but I feel like there are a couple of moments in this movie where I think the homage, and I get that they do the swerve, they pull the rug out from underneath you when you get the what the fuck moment, but I feel like it's too much of a reference back to the other films and to Dr. Loomis to be like, here's this doctor who studied Michael Myers who's just wandering around through the plot this whole fucking time. And then the what the fuck moment happens where he all of a sudden fucking stabs the fucking sheriff in the neck. Complete bullshit to me. Like the whole fucking thing just did not ring true whatsoever.
It didn't work.
I hated it. It was
like, yeah, me too.
Like to me, it was, I get what you're saying, Justin. It was like they needed to force the plot from this place to this place. And they didn't really think of a better way to do it. So they just made this dude fucking snap and stabs him in the fucking neck and everything.
It's a commentary. I know that it's a commentary on the obsession, the modern day obsession with serial killers. It's a thing that's, it's very apparent in our current culture right now.
We
love
it.
True crime.
I hated it,
but it took it to a moment. I think what they were trying to do, they were trying to misdirect you. And then when it came to that part of the film, be like a cool what the whoa moment, like a cool twist. But what it actually turned out to be is like a what the fuck moment. This doesn't work. He puts the mask on.
Yeah, man, what?
And then you kill one of the more interesting characters in the movie. Will Patton plays Officer Hawkins, very likable. He's one of the characters that actually connects back to the original film because he was one of the first officers on the scene to capture Michael Myers in the original. And then you kill him off like that? I was like, I was starting to feel for this character. I liked him a lot. And then you kill him like that? Like
I was on board up until he puts Michael's body in the back seat with Allison, and he throws the mask back there as well. He puts the mask on for a few seconds, and then he takes it off and throws the mask in the back seat. And I'm like, this is so clunky because it's apparent that the only reason that this is in the film is because the screenwriters were sitting down there like, oh shit, how do we get Michael to Laurie's place?
Because it's hidden. It's out in the middle of nowhere. She's specifically made her home.
And then the scene continues to not make sense because it doesn't properly explain how he knows where he's going. How does he know where Laurie's house is?
I'm just thankful with this entire subplot. It's mercifully short-lived. His turn, his what the fuck moment, that whole, and you're right, Lois, as clunky is the perfect word for it because it brings this entire film, which up to this point is legitimately like 10 out of 10 type material. It's fucking perfect in almost every single way to a grinding halt, legitimately to a screeching fucking halt. But then it's very short lived and we get one of the most gruesome, awesome kills in the movie.
It's so
as
good.
A result
it's
of
so
it.
Good.
When he gets his fucking
brain stomped in. It's almost worth it. It's almost worth it in the long run. The more I think almost. About it, because when you see it, you're like,
almost.
Almost redeeming. And that may be where they were going with it. We know they did reshoots on this. I'm not going to go too in depth on this. Voice Sauce, you and I, we do have the original shooting script, what they had before they went back and reshot stuff after February. They did have a different ending on this. Thank God they did. But we got to talk about right now one of the best characters of this movie, guys. And me? I know you'll probably both agree.
It's me.
It's not you. Damn. It's not. It's Julian. It's the little boy that's being babysat. This kid literally had me rolling. He's played by a young actor, Jibril Namtambu. And this kid is like one of the shining stars of this movie.
Well, he comes at a perfect moment in this film, too, because we talked about the knife kill through the throat and we talked about the hammer kill. Like, the film has been nothing but nonstop tension at this point. We've seen a bunch of kills. We know he's now loose. And now we get kind of a little break from that to lighten the tension. We get a little bit of a comedic moment between he and the babysitter, which is really, really nice. And like I said, I think there are those moments in this film where I think it really needed that, where I think it really does a great service to this story to lighten things up a little bit, because you can't just have the film relentlessly having Michael Myers just straight mow people down the whole time.
Like, and we get babysitting. We get the one thing that is overkill in the original film. It's a great throwback to that, like a modern teenager babysitting a modern young boy who's got a mouth on him, but he's extremely savvy. The whole thing, like, I know y'all talking about smoking weed, Alakazam.
Clipping my nasty-ass, crusty-ass toenails.
Dude, he's hilarious. And he's like, you go up there, Dave. I was like rolling on this shit. But then, of course, he's also a throwback to Tommy Doyle in the original movie. Like, he's the little boy that's like, I see the boogeyman. Man, I seen him out there. I can hear him breathe him. And it builds up to that scene. So that whole scene was just perfection, in my opinion. And he had a great chemistry as well in that sequence.
I wish we figured out what happened to him. I guess
he runs out. He's gone.
I guess.
He's a smart kid. He's not a dumb kid that's going to hang around. He watches a little bit of the kill. Then he's like, fuck this. I'm fucking out of here.
Yeah. I wonder if he'll return for the sequel.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they can make good use of him again, unless it's like a one-off. Like, little, he shows up in the movie and then quickly disappears from it.
There is that one moment in that scene. I love that scene. That's another one of my favorite scenes. Just so perfectly built up to. And as you said, Nick, the comedy relief in there, it was a nice moment of being light. Gives you a moment to breathe a little bit as we're seeing Allison at the dance with her douchebag boyfriend, Cameron, which... that's one of my only issues of the movie that I have under my belt.
Another scene.
Why did I not get to see him get killed? You won't make us want to hate him, and then don't get to see him get killed.
That's another scene that I feel like they were sitting down at the table writing the script, and they were like, we need a way to have Allison's cell phone not work, or we need to get rid of her, we need to get rid of her cell phone.
Is that pudding, Nick? What the fuck was that?
It was weird. It was something like thick,
you're going to have that
some
in
kind
high school
of viscous
dance?
Material.
What is that?
Yeah. It wasn't punch.
No, it definitely wasn't punch, because it was thick enough. Like, the phone still clearly worked because it was still ringing when it was in it. And I'm just like, your phone works just perfectly fine. You could just reach over there and grab. Like, the whole thing, like, there are moments like that in the film where it's really, like, you get what they're trying to go for, and it just doesn't land 100%.
It doesn't. And that scene that Justin's talking about, where the kid from Blockers, I don't know the actor's name, but he's out there. And he's revving the motorcycle. And I was thinking in my brain, like, oh, okay, this makes sense as to why he's revving the motorcycle, because that way he won't hear her screaming inside when Michael attacks her. But then he stops revving the engine when the motorcycle accidentally tips over. And that's before she starts screaming
before
inside.
Before Vicky starts screaming inside, yeah. So what was the point of seeing him go outside to smoke a joint to go sit on the motorcycle to start it up? It may have to do with reshoots. It may certainly have to do with reshoots, because that scene makes absolutely no sense other than him outside the house and not have him inside the house at the time. But
then he just enters the house. It just doesn't...
Edited things where that was meant to be popped in just a little bit later and got shuffled in the wrong place or something
like
that.
Yeah, I think the editing in this film, I mean, it's very well paced, but like stuff like that, I feel like is just like, what? Like,
before
you're just watching.
Before we get to the list of Easter eggs / homages that I'm going to run through at the end of this review before we get to our ratings, I feel like, guys, we have to talk about the ending, which is one of the best climaxes I've seen in a Halloween movie and a horror movie in a long time. The showdown between Laurie Strode and Michael Myers. Whoa. When he finally gets there.
Hang on. You are not skipping to the ending of this film before we talk about my favorite fucking kill, and that's the motherfucking cop-o-lantern. Dude. Turns Cop-O-Lantern the motherfucker's skull into a jack-o'-lantern.
It is great. I love that scene. That is very, very good.
And you don't get, that's one of the kills you don't get to see on screen, and I'm glad you don't, because I don't want to fucking... Jesus, God.
How long would it have taken him to actually do that?
I don't care.
It was glorious. That's the only thing, but...
It is
great, though.
Like, I fucking adored it, because he's sitting in the other cop's fucking lap, and he's in the cop car, he's fucking dead.
The other cop, yeah, he's got his neck slashed and everything.
Jammed him through the fucking neck and the skull and the fucking light shot. Like, holy fucking nasty, sick, brutal shit. Adored that.
Once Dr. Sartain is killed, the build up from there is just perfect. It just builds and builds and builds. And then he doesn't, and I'm not sure if Michael Myers is even aware of where he is. Because he's unconscious, I guess we're supposed to believe, with all that talk about Laurie Strode. Then when he gets out, he kills the doctor, and then Allison runs off, and then he's just there. I think we're supposed to believe that the first time he sees her, when she looks out the window, I'm not totally sure. This is after three viewings, too. I'm not sure. I think it's just implied that he first notices when he first looks through the window and sees her peeking out. But for me, I feel like the ending is perfect. And when you actually hear what the original ending was, you'll think so even more. The climax here is just, it's built up so perfectly.
Well, and it has one of the biggest fan-pleasing moments, I feel like, that got applause at a couple of the screenings that I was in attendance at the Alamo Drafthouse, where it pays homage to the original again, but in a way where it twists it, and that is when Michael and Laurie are struggling, and she falls off the balcony, and it's a direct callback to the original, in which Dr. Loomis shoots Michael. He falls off the balcony. He looks. The body's there. He looks away. He looks back. The body's gone. It's the exact same thing, but Laurie Strode this time. So the tables have turned. And that got genuine applause from the audience.
Very loud applause on my second viewing. Yeah, it was insane. I loved that.
So,
and she's stalking
him.
Make no mistake. He's in there. He's after her. But she's the one. She's been preparing for this for 40 years. She's after him. She's searching for him. She's narrowing down the areas where he is. She's setting a perimeter, basically. She's like military style cutting. Okay, he's not in here. He's not in here. And she's trying to corner him. And she doesn't hold back at all.
I think the only, and I mean the only, and this is because I am not the horror guy. You guys are. But the movie has the most horror movie-ish ending it could possibly have, because they trap him in the room down below. And they set it on fire, and they're like, peace out, bitch, and they just fucking leave.
Nick, do you want to know the original ending?
Tell me in a minute. But to me, that's like the most, like, for me, if I'm in this character's shoes, I've waited 40 years, and I want him dead so fucking bad, I'm going to put the bullet in his fucking head myself, and I'm going to make sure he's fucking dead. Instead, Laurie Strode, legit, fucking, they trap him down below, the fire starts, and they're all just like, peace, bitch, and they just fucking leave him down there. That's
well,
the most
Nick, I
horror
feel-
movie ending you could possibly have, and for me, it's, for Laurie's character motivation, I just don't think it works.
For me, the ending shot of this movie is what makes this movie so perfect. All three of their arcs are completed within this story, especially Laurie.
That's why
three
the
generations of Strode
really works.
Yes, three generations of Strode, they finally believe her. They finally banded together with her and supported her. She's finally defeated
the
trauma.
Became a
She's
family.
Finally faced it. Yep. And their family together, they're a cohesive unit.
Yeah.
Make no mistake, let's touch on it now. The Me Too movement is definitely here in subtext to an extent. It's not on the nose, it's not like being thrown at you in the face, but it's there. This is the trauma. I've waited so much time to deal with this. No one believed me. No one wanted to support me with this. And I've finally got this. You're now finally here to support me and help me fight this. And with your help as a family, we can do this together. And that's what they did. And that's how I felt. The hand of the youngest generation of Strode is clenched tightly on that bloody knife at the end. Like, we're not going to fuck around anymore. We're going to fight back. We fought back, and that's, we're the ones in control now. And that's why that shot, it zooms in, and then it's a just like a static freeze shot, freeze frame yeah. shot on the hand with the knife. And that to me was like, you nailed it. That's all I needed.
A perfect way to end the movie, definitely.
I think it's the perfect culmination of their respective character arcs, because they've been alienated and kind of estranged from one another as a family the entire film, and that they're able to find their way back, you know, to each other. And it takes, unfortunately, it takes more trauma to kind of bring them to that point. But you end this film in a better place character wise for the three Strode women, especially as a cohesive unit, like together as a family. And I think that that's amazing. The ending still really works for me in that regard. I know I'm nitpicking when I say the horror ending. I get it. But I love the character arcs of these three characters coming full circle and coming to completion in such a good place. And it's amazing that they come together in such a good place. Like, even to be 100% honest, the way that this film ended with their character arcs, whether the characters had lived or died, to me, didn't matter at that point, because they came full circle as characters and they finally understood each other, I think, for the first time in their lives, and finally forgave each other, I think, for the first time in their lives, for the pain that they had caused each other, for just how hard they had made things for each other at times. And I loved that. I absolutely adored that about it. That's why I love the performances of this film. That's why this film is as good as it is to me. The kills are great. The shape is great. All that stuff is great. The tension is great. The threat that he is great, but nothing is as good as the character arcs of the three Strode women. Nothing.
Except for maybe
the score.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Literally, I've been listening to it for weeks. Weeks. John Carpenter, Cody Carpenter, who we've actually had on the Epic Film Guys podcast, and Daniel Davies, John Carpenter's godson, nailed it. They fucking knocked it out of the park with this score. Literally one of the best synthesizer-driven horror scores of recent years, and most definitely one of the best scores of the entire series. I just love this score. Literally, it's modern, it's old school. There's definitely that John Carpenter touch. It's definitely his score, but it's still got that modern feel to it at the same time, which
are old themes and
balances it perfectly.
Amazing new themes. Yes.
Let's do it, gentlemen. Let's throw the number ratings on it. I'm going to throw an 8 out of 10 on this. I really, really enjoyed pretty much everything about the film. Nitpicks about podcasting aside, I really, really did enjoy it. But, you know, it's really good. I think I would stand it up right there next to the original. I think it makes a perfect companion to the original. I think it's really great how they seamlessly, like, you can kind of move from one right into the other, I think. It's been a while since I've watched the original, but I just remember that about it. You know, I think you can go from those final shots of Michael Myers just on the ground. You know, Loomis shoots him, and then you can flash forward 40 years and he's incarcerated and Laurie Strode's like legitimately broken from the post-traumatic stress. I think it's perfect. I think it makes a perfect companion. I think they went a really, really smart direction when they decided to write it. I think that the only problem this film has is just the second act. I think the second act, it just sags a bit because they deviate a little bit too much. They focus a little bit too much on shitty characters that suck. Doctor, whatever the fuck your name is. And you mentioned you called him the Jonah Hill of the movie. Didn't really care for that either. I was like, no, go away.
But I love his kill, though. His kill
is
great.
His kill's great.
And I love seeing him get
his
stalked.
Kill's great.
And,
his kill's absolutely great. But I like that whole, I was just like, go away. Just get, God. Like, that whole thing was just, it kind of dragged it out for me a little bit. But then once that third act begins, you know, once you get Michael Myers on the way to and at Laurie Strode's home and that whole final confrontation, it's just masterful. Absolutely masterful. So that's it. 8 out of 10 for me. I'm going to kick it over to the god of podcasting. We're going to make Justin be quiet for a minute. And we're going to throw it over to the sauce.
This is the god of podcasting giving Halloween an 8 out of 10.
You're not my dad.
In a way, isn't
I am
Lord
your
Sauce
dad.
Is everyone's dad? Isn't he everyone's dad?
Yes. As I said before, I think this comes as close to the original as you possibly can. I do think, nitpicks aside, Some of the humor did not work for me at all. A couple of scenes made me go, what? That don't make no sense. But overall, the film is incredibly impressive. It's a fun time at the movies, and it's also meaningful. It means something to me, because as someone who loves this franchise, who loves these characters of Laurie Strode and Michael Myers, and exploring those characters in a way that is almost emotional in a way, almost like a rite of passage. I know this movie made tons of money. I kind of hope that we leave it well enough alone, but of course we know that's not going to happen. Justin, your ratings for the film, please.
Well, this movie knocked my fucking socks off, and I loved it. And it did for me everything, for the most part, that I really hoped it would do. This movie was a love letter to Halloween fans and to fans of the genre in general. We don't get these very often. Ladies and gentlemen, this was a very special thing. And for me, I gotta go big or go home. I'm giving Halloween 2018 a 9 out of 10 rating. It almost hit the mark of being a perfect Halloween film and a perfect movie of the genre for me. I don't like the Dr. Sartain twist at all. But watching it three times, when that moment comes and goes, it's easy for me to forgive, because when they get to Laurie Strode's home, it's literally one of the best things out of any Halloween film I've ever seen. Laurie is done with so much respect, and Jamie Lee Curtis gives a career best performance in this film. The kills are brutal, but respectful of the original. The atmosphere is there. It feels like the season of Halloween. The score is amazing. What more could I ask for? I can't fucking wait to see this movie again. I love this movie so much, I'm getting the new version of Michael Myers, The Shape, tattooed on my fucking leg. And in the next 3 weeks, I'm going to all the filming locations of this movie. That's how much I love this. 9 out of 10 for me. David Gordon Green's Halloween.
All right, and gentlemen, that is going to wrap it up for us here on another episode of the Epic Film Guys podcast. Check it out. Go see Halloween if you have not had a chance to see it yet. Go see Bad Times at the El Royale as well. Can't wait until these two see it so I can actually talk to people about it.
Don't forget, if you are interested in EFG swag, we have all of our merchandise on our Redbubble store, redbubble.com/epicfilmguys. We have our brand new Epic Film Guys Halloween-centric shirt available right now for purchase. All proceeds go to Second Chances Wildlife
today, too,
Rehabilitation Center, which are going to help all of those animals in need. JB, Justin Beaver, they're building a dam for him. He needs a dam. Help out, buy a shirt. Help those animals out and sport some Halloween spooky goodness at the same time.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we love you. Thank you so much for listening to the show, for supporting the show. We really, really appreciate it. Check out Before the Month is Over, hashtag All the Horror, over on Twitter. Again, our collaboration with Two Girls on a Bench about William Friedkin's The Exorcist just hit Monday the 22nd. Nosferatu earlier in the month, and I'm going to be talking Insidious with the movie Geek and Proud Guys. That was a lot of fun to record as well.
You're not my dad.
Jeez. But until next time, ladies and gentlemen, for Justin, for myself, for the, ladies and gentlemen, the, not a, the God of Podcasting,
Loy Sloth.
Thank you all very, very much for listening, and we will see you
at
the movies.
I bet you that's how he breathes after he ejaculates too, like.
Can we not? It's disgusting.
I already took it to that place. It's too late. I can't take it back now.
And I stop.
Yeah, stop recording.